Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Valerie Francis, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Jari Bolander, Anne Holly, Kim Kessler, and Leslie Watts. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global foolscap worksheet, then discuss it using the editor's six core questions. This week, we're leaping into the 2000 martial arts action movie, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Screenplay by Hui-Ling Huang, directed by Ang Lee, and based on the novel of the same name by Huang Dulu. Here's a synopsis of the story that we have freely adapted from Wikipedia. Our story involves five principal characters. There's a mature pair, the master swordsman Mu Bai, and a professional woman bodyguard named Xu Lian, who have long been repressing their strong feelings for one another. There is a pair of young lovers, Jen, who's the daughter of a high-ranking official, and Lo, a handsome desert bandit. And finally, there is Jade Fox, who's a former pupil of Mu Bai the swordsman. Jade Fox has been posing as Jen's governess for years. When a thief steals the famous sword Green Destiny, Mu Bai and Xu Lian trace the theft erroneously to Jade Fox. It's not until a big showdown between them that the mysterious female warrior appears with the Green Destiny. It's Jen. She's been secretly studying the martial arts, and she has surpassed Jade Fox in skill and is the one who has stolen the Green Destiny. She lets Jade Fox escape. At night, the handsome desert bandit Lo breaks into Jen's bedroom and asks her to leave with him. In flashback, we learn that they have met before and were passionately in love. Back then, Lo told Jen the legend of a man who had made a wish by leaping from a high precipice, and because his heart was pure, he survived. Lo has now come to Beijing to persuade Jen not to go through with her arranged marriage. At first she refuses, but on her wedding night, she runs away from her husband disguised in male clothing. When she's accosted at an inn by a large group of warriors, the Green Destiny, as well as her own superior combat skills, give her the victory. Jen next confronts Xu Lian, who still hopes to retrieve the Green Destiny and return it to its owner. Xu Lian is the superior fighter, but with the fabled sword, Jen is able to destroy each weapon that Xu Lian wields, until finally Xu Lian manages to defeat her with a broken sword. Mu Bai arrives and pursues Jen into a bamboo forest, where, in the culminating scene, he confronts her and offers to take her on as his student. She agrees, but only if he can take the Green Destiny from her in three moves. Of course, he does it in one. Jen goes back on her word and flees. Mu Bai throws the sword over a waterfall and she dives in after it. She's rescued by Jade Fox, who drugs her and puts her in a cavern. When Mu Bai and Xu Lian discover her, Jade Fox attacks them with poison darts. Mu Bai mortally wounds Jade Fox, only to realize that one of the darts has hit him in the neck. Xu Lian can't save him. With his final breath, Mu Bai confesses his love for her and dies in her arms. The Green Destiny is returned to its rightful owner in Beijing, and Jen spends one last night with her bandit lover, Lo. The next morning, in an echo of the old legend, she asks him to make a wish. He wishes for them to be together back in the desert. Jen then jumps off the side of the mountain. Okay, so that is a quick synopsis of the film. And as usual, we're going to go through the six core questions, and we're going to start with a discussion of genre. And for that, I'm going to throw it over to Kim.
Thanks, Valerie. So this movie is epic in so many ways, and we all agree this is the most difficult movie to really nail down on the genre. So we're all over the map today, but we all have really interesting ideas that back up what we're thinking. So I am very excited about this discussion, and I think it'll be a really rich learning experience for everybody. It really feels like there's numerous cross-genre elements. We have action with life and death stakes and so many amazing fight scenes. We have two love stories, although they are very tragic. We have much of the society genre. We're dealing with class divide, gender roles, and we also have elements of crime. We have a mystery thief, and we have a murderer in hiding who needs to be brought to justice. Personally, after watching the movie multiple times, I propose that the external genre for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, for our purposes today, is in fact a Western. Aaron had said last season when we were doing True Grit that a Western is a tricky genre in itself. It's a combination of action, crime, and society. And then there's a specific setting of a wide open, harsh landscape, which is one of the key attributes. You know, normally we see this in the American West with a specific time period following the Civil War. So here, obviously, that's very different. But the point is that it's some kind of frontier where you get this unique play of the individual versus society. So the values at stake become freedom versus subjugation, and the individual is seeking their own freedom versus that subjugation of society. And the full range of values being subjugation perceived as freedom, to subjugation, to restraint, to autonomy. So we're dealing with these elements, manifest destiny, if you will, and also that individual versus that machine of society and all its requirements and tradition and cultural expectations. So here it's a little different because we're in China. This story is not taking place in the American West. It's taking place within an entirely different culture. But for me, it felt like the most clear match when it came to an external genre. Within the show notes, you'll see a lot of additional material about the original novel and the original author, and that the original novel is considered a wuxia romance, and the original author is considered one of the masters of that genre. That information will be in the show notes, as well as links to all the different places that I went on my journey to really capture those things. In Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I see that there are elements of both the vengeance subgenre as well as the transition subgenre. So vengeance with regard to Mubai is hunting down Jade Fox for her past crimes, and somewhat transition for Jen. She begins in these upper ranks of society as the daughter of a governor, but she is the one who rejects society's expectations for her life and basically transitions herself out of it. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that when it comes to this specific wuxia genre that is specific to martial heroes in Chinese literature, it reminded me when I was reading about it, it's a lot like a noir crime story in that it specifically emerged in this specific time period so that people could metabolize, you know, what was happening to them. So in this case, they have a specific need to break from the societal constraints and experience freedom and autonomy that they didn't have under imperialism. Now for the internal, Norman Friedman has a really excellent model to walk through how to come to your conclusions about genre. And his first rule is you identify the protagonist, and the protagonist is going to be the person that undergoes the most change, is of chief interest to the audience, and whom all else the plot revolves. So for me, in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, this person is Jen. And so then next, we're going to look at different elements of her. So we're looking at her character and behavior, kind of like her morality, her attitudes and beliefs, which are her worldview, and her reputation and well-being, which are her status. At the beginning of the story, we then look at those elements across the story and see how they change and compare them to at the end and see, okay, which one changed the most and how do the other two relate? In seeking her independence and freedom, you know, she rejected this path of honor several times. You know, she denies the teacher, she insults him, because Mubai offered to teach her multiple times. And, you know, she's so stuck on just not being subjugated anymore that she rejects the honor of the teacher. And Jen is very naive. In as much as she's capable with her martial arts ability, she still is not fully understanding the ramifications of the real lifestyle that she's seeking to be a part of. She doesn't fully understand it or respect it. And she thinks she can do it without being held to its standards. So she doesn't fully understand this, the effect of her choices, until it's too late. And for me, this ultimately leads to despair. So she gains freedom and independence in the end. She's no longer subjugated because she chooses to free herself from it. But it's the negation of the negation in terms of status. It's kind of like selling out. And so for me, it really makes the internal genre status tragic. So the values at stake here are failure and success. And so it's failure masked as a success. So I feel like for external, we have Western. For internal, it feels like a status tragic. And so when we're doing a controlling idea, you know, we say the value at stake, whether it's positive or negative, you know, whether it's going to prevail or fail based on these circumstances. So it feels like a cautionary tale with a negative ending. And yet that Western portion seems to end positively. She does gain this independence and she's no longer subjugated in the way that she didn't want. So in all of that, it makes me believe that the status tragic is in fact the global genre, because the way I was able to put a controlling idea together was by listing the value at stake in a status, which in this case, it feels like the negation of the negation. So failures masked as a hollow success occur when we seek independence without regard to honor, or I would maybe even amend it to say when the naive seek independence without regard to honor. And so that's where I landed. I'm calling this a status tragic when it comes to the global, because it really feels like she becomes very disillusioned and then also falls into despair and then gives up on the dream that she had and jumps. And whether she dies or not is yet to be seen, but it feels very tragic and sad. She's leaving low. You know, it's not like she's – it's not this big success. So that's where I'm at with it. I'm saying it's a Western. I'm saying it's status tragic, and but I'm saying that the internal feels global in this case. So I cannot wait to hear what everybody else has to say about it, because I know it's going to be so fascinating. And everything I think that everyone says today is full of merit, because we all looked at it from so many angles so hard, you know. So back to you, Valerie.
Thanks, Kim. It's interesting when we look at the genre of this story, because it was marketed as an action film. And I can see where Kim is coming from in terms of influences from action and crime and society. And because Western is a mix of those three, I can see where you're coming from. However, personally, I think this is a women's society story that ends negatively. Yes, there's a crime in it, but it's not really a mystery as to who stole the Green Destiny. Julianne knows who it is right from the beginning. There's lots of action in the film. The martial arts scenes really are fantastic. But I don't think it has – the story turns on the value shift of an action film. So an action story turns on life and death. And I think this turns on the society global value of impotence and power. So someone going from being powerless to being powerful. Now, the Western global value is very similar to that, but it would be, wouldn't it, if the Western is a combination of society action and crime. There is definitely a stunning landscape. And in a Western, the landscape is a character in the story. So while I think that there is definitely a breathtaking landscape and the cinematography is really worth watching the film for, if nothing else, I don't think it's a character at all. And I don't think that the story really follows the obligatory scenes and conventions for the Western or for the action. So why am I saying that this is women's society? Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is about fundamentally a woman who wants to have the power to control her own life, her own destiny. She wants to make the decisions about her own life. So just like when Kim was struggling to find some strategy to come up with what the genre was for this film, my strategy is to ask myself, fundamentally, what is the story about? And when I get that, then I start to look at the obligatory scenes and conventions and the global value shift to see if it fits. I've got a lot of information in the show notes, but I'll just go over a couple of points here now briefly. Society stories are about rebelling against a system. And that's what Jen is doing. She's powerless. She has to marry the man that her parents have chosen for her. To do otherwise would disgrace her family. And we learn in the course of the film that one of the reasons they've chosen this man as a match for her is because it's very good for her father's career, which in ancient China is very important. But she doesn't love this man. She loves Lo. Even when Lo comes and says, come with me, live with me in the desert, she refuses him because he is dictating to her what her future will be. And she doesn't want to do that. She wants to be free, but it isn't an option for her. Society stories are also mini plots. And I think this film is a mini plot, although we can argue that of the five main characters, Jen is probably the biggest. She can't be free in the material physical world. Death is her only option for freedom. Now, there is some crossover in the obligatory scenes and conventions between a society and action. However, I don't think all of the action obligatory scenes and conventions are abided by. I think the society obligatory scenes and conventions are abided by. And I've got those all listed in the show notes. But I'll just give you an example. One of the key conventions of the society genre, the society story, is that there's one central character with offshoot characters that embody a multitude of the main character's personality traits. So Jen is the main character. The other four, I think, are circling her. Shulian represents her ideal self, Jen's ideal self. Mubai represents her higher or spiritual self. Lo, the desert bandit, represents her wild side and her desire for freedom. And Jade Fox represents her shadow side. Also, I think this story has a win but lose but win ending. What Jen wants is freedom, and the only way she can have it is through death. So while she wins her freedom, she loses her life. Now, I know we talked a little bit before we started recording that did Jen know that she was going to die when she jumped off the mountain? Maybe, maybe not, because we can see her flying at different points in the film. I think that was a conscious choice to commit suicide at the end. That was my reading of it. So it's a win but lose but win ending. And so that's my take on it. Leslie, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'm clinging still to action because I do see that the obligatory scenes and conventions are met. And I'll talk about the conventions when we actually get to the conventions. But to me, there's commentary on society. I see that the yearning for freedom is more about Jen's internal genre, because the climactic moment doesn't seem to be about exposing tyrants, but surviving and staying alive. So I think also that we have a film that has lots of Chinese influences. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we've got that really intense action aspect of Wong Fu from Hong Kong that includes those beautiful aerobatic martial arts. And then with the wires, so the characters seem to fly and jump over buildings, and that fosters this sense of magical realism. Then we have the classic landscapes and aesthetics and the social construct of communist mainland China. And then we have modern psychology influences from Taiwan. And of course, we also have Western influences. It's fun to talk about this story that has Western genre implications, but also influence from the US and Europe and those kinds of stories. But what I would say is that there's some of that as well. And I suspect that that's the part that feels like a Western. So it can be hard to discern in the story which parts are influenced by China and their cultural influences, and then which parts are coming because Ang Lee was definitely trying to make a Chinese film that would be acceptable and popular in the United States and Europe. And so that was part of the intent. So you have all of those ingredients in there. Another thing that was interesting is that I saw a description of this story as Chinese pulp historical action, which was awesome. But at bottom, I think that this is kind of a functional equivalent of Western, but not precisely a Western. Jen is not seeking justice, it seems to me. So I think actually that Ang Lee was probably pursuing a separate genre, a new genre that just didn't really take off. And then in terms of the internal genre, something to be aware of is that different cultures, the values are prioritized differently. And so that's something you want to consider when you're looking at stories that are not from the US or Western Europe. Oh, and to me, the ending was really ambiguous because she's been flying throughout the film and that she's making a wish and hoping her heart is pure enough that her wish will be granted. And she's has a hopeful look on her face. She doesn't seem in despair or resignation. So to me, that's telegraphing that she's hopeful that her wish will be granted because her heart is pure.
I'll have to go back and have a look at the last scene again, because I don't remember the look on her face as being hopeful, although I'm willing to be proven wrong on that point. So you've got me curious now, Leslie. I want to go back and have a look at that. So one of the things that Sean talks about in his methodology is that priority number one is to pick a genre and stick with it. The reason being, when you have genre mashups, it gets confusing for the audience. And I don't know about any of you who have seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or the other editors here on the roundtable, but I think if I wasn't watching this film with an intent to analyze it, I would have come at the end and wondered, okay, wait a minute, what just happened? What was this story about? And I did have a little bit of that, I admit, when I finished watching it the first time, but because I am who I am and this was an analysis project for us, I really had to dig. Even with all of the education and the knowledge that I have about story grid theory and methodology, I still had to dig, as did Leslie, as did Kim, and we came up with three totally different points of view. So that to me is fascinating. Moving on with the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. Jari, would you like to walk us through that, please?
Yeah, great. Awesome discussion so far. It's going to get even a little more awesome and muddled, I think, as I go through this. One thing to note, just trivia-wise, this movie did not do well in China for whatever reason, and they were shocked that it did so well in the U.S., even though it was subtitled. So it just goes to show that whatever this is, it worked at some level, and it's just a beautiful, beautifully shot, and there's lots of great nuances. So when we talk about the beginning hook, we like to label like what that means in just a real short sentence. And for me, it's freedom has a price. And so the inciting incident of the beginning hook and the whole movie is a mass thief sneaks into Sir Tai's estate and steals the Green Destiny. And this Green Destiny is the sword. Progressive complication and sort of why that's interesting is that whoever this thief is very well trained and trained in something called Wudang, which is very rare. And they're like, huh, we know all the Wudang people. Like, how could you have been trained? But the real crisis question in the beginning hook is they know that someone inside the governor's compound stole the Green Destiny. They just don't know who it is. They suspect it's someone, it's Jade Fox, but they're not sure. And then the climax of the beginning hook is when Su Lien shows up at Governor Yu's compound to visit with Zhen, since Su Lien suspects Zhen as the thief. And then the resolution is Su Lien agrees to be like a sister to Zhen. And I think that's just so she can be closer to kind of monitor her, because Zhen is conflicted in terms of her, where she sits in the world. She clearly doesn't want to get married, which we've talked about. And then the middle build, this is where Jade Fox reveals herself. And the inciting incident is the Yellow Hill fight with Jade Fox when the inspector comes and confronts Jade Fox, and they find out, oh, it's the governess, it's Jen's governess. And the progressive complication is that actually Jen stole the Green Destiny without asking Jade Fox's permission. And then also Jen is better than Jade Fox. And we see a little bit more about that when Jade confronts Jen in the ending payoff. And so we also like to put in what's called the midpoint shift, which is not story grid per se, but for me, it's when we find out that Jen stole the Green Destiny and she really does have a gift for Wudang. So she's just this expert swordsman. And the thing you have to know about the Wudang style is they don't allow women. And we'll hear a little bit more about that a little later. But now the crisis question in the middle build is Mu Bai, who's a master in Wudang, wants to convince Jen to be her master. And so can he do that? And then how is she going to react to that? And then there's also, they're trying to find Jade Fox and they want to lure her out again. And they really think that it'll be at this wedding. But lo and behold, in the climax scene of the wedding procession, Lo, Jen's lover in this case, shows up to the wedding and asks Jen to run away with him. And then a big fight ensues and they chase Lo off. But then Jen also disappears. And then the resolution of the whole middle build is now Jen is going off on her own. She's quote unquote free. She's dressed as a boy named Master Long. And Mu Bai and Su Lien go off to find her. So now there's this quest. And then in the ending payoff, for me, this is a fateful heart makes wishes come true, which is sort of the saying that they originally talked about when Lo talks about someone jumping off a mountain. So the ending payoff has that theme. The inciting incident is Jen shows up at Shulian's compound wanting advice, and then they start fighting each other. And we mentioned that she's really excellent martial artist, pretty much defeats all of Shulian's weapons. Progressive complications. Mu Bai still wants to be Jen's master, even if she doesn't want him to. And then he throws the sword and she dives after it and Jen Fox saves her. The crisis of this whole ending payoff is can Jen live the life she wants? And that's very apparent when, you know, Jade Fox ambushes them all and has the poison darts, and there's a whole wonderful scene and it happens really quick. Even when Mu Bai gets hit with the dart and, you know, knows he's going to die. The climax is that Jen goes to the edge of the cliff to see if she has a fateful heart and asks Lo to make a wish. And then the resolution of the whole movie. And again, we don't know if she dies or not, but she jumps off and it appears that she's flying and then fade to black. So, you know, I looked at it from Jen's as a character's perspective, because I do believe that she's the main protagonist. And it's just such a wonderfully shot film. And you even see the contrasting in gender roles, which I think is what I think everyone's seeing. Is it a Western? Is it a society of women? Is it a... He mixed a lot of things together. Kind of reminds me of Hot Fuzz, but maybe it's the Asian version of Hot Fuzz. And I've got some more comments in the show notes about some of the wonderful things that they did and some of the new... and unique things that hadn't been seen in the West before. So, Anne, I think you had a couple more thoughts.
Just a short note on the title of the movie, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, is a, let me see if I can do this right, Wo Hu, Kang Long, refers to concealed talents or talented individuals in hiding. And it's a saying, it's apparently attached to a longer story that people generally in the culture know, that reminds us never to underestimate anybody. And it seems to apply to Jen, to Mu Bai, and to Jade Fox. But also, this four-character phrase is called a Cheng Yu. And it's a phrase in Chinese that alludes to a whole story, one that's presumably well-known, and a bit like we would refer to the tortoise and the hare, and then everybody kind of can evoke that whole fable along with it about haste versus deliberation. What I noticed was that when Lo, the desert bandit, is talking about the story of the pure-hearted man who jumps, twice he enunciates four distinct words very clearly that sounded to me also like a Cheng Yu. So the pure heart something something, and I didn't get it, strikes me as the other side of the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon secrets in hiding. There's sort of the openness and pure-heartedness that wins in the end. And I thought that might give us maybe a Chinese-speaking, a Mandarin-speaking viewer a little more of a clue into the depths of what Ang Lee was going for in this movie.
And great, great job on the pronunciation, Anne.
Thank you.
That's a tough one.
Thanks, Anne. And Kim, did you have something you wanted to add as well?
Yeah, I wanted to say in the researching the original novel, which is actually the fourth novel in a pentology, they're called the Crane Iron Pentology, and all of the titles are exactly as you're saying, the Cheng Yu four words like that. Again, the link will be in the show notes. You can go to Wikipedia and read about it. I really looked around to try to find a synopsis for the entire pentology, but I cannot find one. So if anybody can find a link to either a copy of them or a synopsis of what all four of the stories are, I would love it if you would share it with us on Twitter at StoryGridRT. That would be a really fun thing to unearth. The only other thing I wanted to mention was Jari was mentioning the gender roles and that kind of thing. And that too was in the original stories. Each novel is about a pair. There's four generations, I believe, of pairs of male and female characters. And, you know, they are written as these martial hero romances. So they're going to have all those pairs. And I love that the material written in the 30s has all this stuff in it. And it's just, I would just love to read the original ones.
Excellent. And I noticed that there's a follow-up film as well. And Shulian is the protagonist of that one. I haven't watched it yet, but I've got it in my list on Netflix to watch. Okay, so we're going to continue on with the obligatory scenes and conventions of an action story. So, Anne, would you like to bring us through the obligatory scenes, please?
Well, I'm not sure that we are talking about an action story, but since the obligatory scenes among the various genres that we've looked at, many of them are similar, let's just go with what we've got here and see what we find.
Okay.
The first obligatory scene of the action and several other genres is an inciting attack by the villain or the environment. We all seem to agree that the inciting incident of the story is the theft of the Green Destiny from the home of Sirte while under Shulian's watch. But if this is a society women's story, it's possible to see the global inciting incident as when Lo and his bandits raid Jen's family caravan in the desert, even though we only see this at the midpoint in flashback, because possibly that's what sets off her great desire to be free. The second obligatory scene is that the hero sidesteps responsibility to take action. Now, I'm operating on the assumption that the hero here is Mu Bai, which nobody else agrees with me on. And he sidesteps by telling Shulian that he's given up the sword when she asked him to come with her and help her with her bodyguarding and security duties. He refuses to continue to wield it, and his gift of it to Sir Tape is what puts that sword within Jen's grasp. So if Jen is the protagonist, then Valerie, you have something to say about that.
Yeah, if I'm going to look at this as an action story, I have to really have a narrow view of the story with Jen as the protagonist. And I think the way she sidesteps responsibility is that she doesn't want to get married. In ancient China, her responsibility was to marry the man that her parents picked out for her. And there are, as we talked about, reasons why they have made this decision and reasons why she needs to honor that request, that decision, that choice that her parents have made for her. But she doesn't want to do that. And in fact, she ultimately runs away before getting married. So that's how I think she sidesteps responsibility.
That seems reasonable. The third, are we on third here? Yes. The third convention is forced to leave the ordinary world. The hero lashes out. Valerie?
Again, if Jen is the hero, and we're looking at this as an action story, I think she is forced to leave the ordinary world when she is being forced to marry, because her ordinary world to that point is a life of freedom, or relative freedom anyway, that is being single and doing what she wants. When she goes into the extraordinary world, that would be marriage. She doesn't want to do that. So she lashes out by stealing the Green Destiny.
Wow. It's tricky, isn't it?
It's really tricky.
The next obligatory scene is discovering and understanding the villain's object of desire, sometimes known as the MacGuffin. Here, the MacGuffin, I think, is pretty clearly the Green Destiny, the sword. Now, Mu Bai doesn't want it anymore, but it represents everything that Jen has been training for in secret for years. So when she steals it, she forces Mu Bai's and Shulian's hands, and they're honor-bound to go after it. It was Jen's object of desire, and it forces the whole action of pursuing and trying to get it back. But it's Jade Fox who's the classical villain. She's a poisoner and a murderer and full of resentment. And her object of desire is not really the Green Destiny. It's the knowledge that Jen has kept from her because poor Jade Fox can't read. But we don't, the audience and nobody else in the story really understands this MacGuffin until almost the closing scene. So the whole question of MacGuffin was a little fuzzy in this movie, along with several other things.
Yeah, and if we're going to look again at Jen as the protagonist, I had to ask myself, who is the villain? So I think we've got a couple. In the marriage story, it would be society / her parents, because they're forcing her to marry and she doesn't want to do that. However, in the broader story and in Jen's desire to be free, Jade Fox, I agree with you, is the force of antagonism. And what does Jade want? First, she wants to train, she wants to mold Jen in her image and train her. However, it becomes a desire to kill Jen, although we don't understand that she wants to kill her until, as you say, almost the last scene when she kills Mu Bai by mistake and says, yeah, well, that's sort of a happy side effect, killing you, Mu Bai. I was really aiming for Jen.
Yeah. So would you say that for Jade Fox, almost Jen is the MacGuffin?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd have to think about that. But, well, I think power. I think Jade wants power and Jen wants power. But I think Knowledge. That's a good question. Knowledge. She just definitely wants knowledge. I agree with you there. Whether her desire to kill Jen is a MacGuffin, I don't know, but I think that becomes her object of desire.
Yeah.
Early on in the story, when she realizes that Jen has been keeping knowledge from her, and she says, well, I still have a lesson or two to teach you. And unbeknownst to the audience, it's at that point that she decides to kill Jen. That becomes her object of desire, but she's not actively pursuing Jen throughout the film.
True. True. Good point. Yeah, it's just another area where the movie breaks rules and keeps us working hard. The next obligatory scene is the hero's initial strategy to outmaneuver the villain fails. Again, we have the question of who's the hero and who's the villain. And it seems to kind of change depending on which obligatory scene you're looking at. For this one, I find myself looking at the first big rooftop fight scene where Julien, as the hero, tries and fails to outmaneuver Jen, the sword thief, and recover the sword.
And I struggled on this one because I can't really convince myself that it's an attempt to outmaneuver. However, looking at Jen as the protagonist and Jade as the antagonist, I think the initial strategy is when Jen tries to reason with Jade and explain that the reason she hid her true talent from her master was so she wouldn't embarrass Jade.
That was a powerful moment, too, in the story.
Well, that's a huge turning point in their relationship. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, right. Very good. That's interesting. Next, the hero reaches an all-is-lost moment when they realize that they must change their approach to salvage some form of victory. I'm going to let you take this one, Valerie.
All I got for this one is that Jen steals the Green Destiny for a second time and runs away.
Okay, then I... But I don't feel so bad about saying I have a hard time pinpointing this one. But if it's Mumbai who's the hero, and he is very heroic, I mean, we relate to him as a hero in some sense, almost as if he's the hero from a prior story that we know well. That's kind of how he's presented. It feels to me like his biggest loss or sacrifice is when Jen, towards the end, more or less forces him to choose the life of action and fighting over his probably preferred life of meditation and enlightenment. That's right at the culminating scene of the fight in the bamboo forest. And that brings us to the final, semi-final obligatory scene, the big showdown or the big confrontation where the hero and the villain face off and the hero's gift is expressed. Depending on which genre we're actually talking about, this could be the hero at the mercy of the villain scene. The showdown in the bamboo forest seems clearly to be intended to be this obligatory scene, the big culminating fight scene. And Mumbai here expresses his gift of total self-control, but he's been expressing that gift all along. I mean, that's who he is. It's possible that there's a kind of enlightenment moment. If you watch Chow Yun-fat closely, he's balancing on the bamboo stalk and he's completely in complete repose. He's in perfect balance and not doing, which is his gift. But to the Western mind, at least, this doesn't feel like much of a big reveal.
No, I agree with you. I do think that the big scene is supposed to be the sword fight in the bamboo forest, but I didn't think that either Jen or Mumbai particularly expressed a gift that wasn't expressed before. First of all, I don't think that Mumbai is the villain. I think he is more of a mentor. Even though the roles can change, it doesn't have to... These archetypes are roles in a story, not characters in a story. I don't think that Mumbai is even fulfilling the role of the villain. He is definitely the role of a mentor here. And at the end of this showdown, he offers to be her master. He wants to train her. He recognizes her ability. Jade is still the villain, in my opinion, here, but they don't have a show. Jen and Jade don't have a showdown. Jade rescues Jen from the water and brings her to the cavern where she drugs her. And there's no showdown at all because, you know, Jen is out of it.
And there's a very slight showdown between Mumbai and Jade Fox.
But it's fast, man.
It's fast and it's, yeah, fast and deadly. And he does kill her. But it doesn't feel like the showdown that we expect at a culminating moment.
Exactly. Kim, did you have anything you wanted to add here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, just echoing what Anne just said, as I'm sitting here listening to you and thinking about it, I feel like that final showdown would be between Mubai and Jade Fox, because he wanted revenge against her the whole time for killing his master. She poisoned his master, again, in a previous story, and she's been, you know, in hiding, and everyone's been trying to bring Jade Fox to justice this entire time. And now this is really, you know, that seems like that final showdown between the hero in this scene is definitely Mubai versus the villain, which is Jade Fox, you know, to protect the victim in this case, which is Jen, because he knows she's been drugged. So this feels like it's his final, the big showdown, because this is really, again, him versus the ultimate villain of the story and his ultimate foe that he wants to take out. She does her darts, right, which are, again, there's a whole symbolism with using poison versus like just coming at someone with a sword. Like, it's maybe considered less honorable. And, you know, the fact that she used poison before, and then he is able to deflect all of the poison darts that are coming at him.
That was
and
cool.
They go right back into her. Right. And it's, she basically, he puts everything that she gives out right back into her, and it's very dramatic. And then, you know, she's going to die, but then we do see that he did get hit with one in the neck, and then she has her last final declaration that she was, you know, wanted to kill Jen and that whole thing. But it feels like just in the culmination of all of the things that had come before, as you were talking all of this out, I just wanted to mention that, yeah, I think the big showdown isn't the bamboo forest thing. I think it is actually in the cave, and that Mubai shows, you know, he stands up as a hero and protects and deflects all of those darts back to the villain that he was after.
Well, it is true that the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek, as Joseph Campbell has taught us. The final obligatory scene is the hero's sacrifice is rewarded, and I just am tearing my hair out at this point, because to find this scene, I have to look at Xu Lian again as the hero. And the reward for all of her self-sacrifice is to hear Mubai express his undying love for her as he dies. I found that terribly sad and moving, but also frustrating from a story structure point of view.
And I couldn't find the scene at all from Jen's point of view. You're looking at Jen as the protagonist. And just one other thing to mention in the showdown, to follow up on what Kim said, if Mubai takes on the hero role in that big showdown, it feels very anticlimactic, at least to my story sensibility, because we've been following Jen and her journey throughout the course of the story. So she's got to be the one to overcome her villain. That's what I feel would work better if this was an action story. You know what I mean?
Right. So that's partially why I'm seeing it as a status tragic, because I think a huge part of it is that what she seeks and what she wants so much is to be, you know, to be a master, to be all these things. And, you know, he's offered so many times to teach her, and she refuses to give in. She refuses to submit to this thing, you know, the order of which someone is taught, and which someone in Wudang is able to be brought up to be a master. And he's willing to go and thinks that, you know, that they'd make an exception for her, even though she's a woman. You know, he talks with Xu Lian about that. And so I think that because she is not able to, you know, she doesn't achieve what she really wants to achieve in that moment. And then the fact that this teacher, this person that believed in her and wanted, you know, to help her, that dies in her place, essentially is a huge part of her tragic fall. And basically the mistake that she made was not recognizing what she needed to do and the actions that she should have taken all of this time. So again, I would say it fits, to me, it fits very well if you're looking at it from this tragic ending.
Okay. And for this hero sacrifice rewarded, neither Anne nor I could really come up with anything here. Jari, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, Mubai does sacrifice himself for Jen when he fights Jade Fox and tries to defeat her. I mean, he's ultimately wants revenge for his master's death, but he is protecting her. This is so complicated in these kind of movies because our Western sensibility can't sometimes see these sort of things, because a lot of these stories have these ironic, tragic endings. You know, it's not always sunny in startup land or wherever you are. You know, it's like, oh, great, another tragic lesson to learn. So, yeah, again, just it's a bit muddled, but I mean, he does sacrifice himself for Jen.
And so his reward then is that he gets to kill Jade?
He gets to kill Jade. He gets to avenge his master's death, which he does. And that's his sole consumption. I mean, he's been doing that throughout the whole thing. And he fulfills his mission. That's why he can die with honor.
I have a question. And Leslie, I'll point this to you because you have been the action expert and have been studying it for your Story Grid edition. As I'm looking at these obligatory scenes, is there an action story that can end negatively? Does that mean the hero has to always win in an action story, or it's not an action story?
And so, Leslie, would you please bring us through the conventions for the action story, please?
Sure. One quick word. You know, we've been following Jen through the story, and then if Mu Bai is the one who actually gets her out of the mercy of the villain, there are certain circumstances where that's okay. And one of the circumstances is where the protagonist has set it up earlier. Like I'm blanking on an example right now, but there are examples where it's not the actual hero, you know, who does the act. It's someone else, but it's someone that the hero has set up by giving them a gift or making a sacrifice for them, or in some way they have put it in motion long before they actually need it. So the conventions, we have a hero, victim, and villain. I'm doing action again. And right, these are roles that have to be clearly defined throughout the story. But what we see in a lot of Asian stories is that the hero is a collective. It's not actually that different from the Guardians of the Galaxy, where you have a central figure and then you've got a lot of sidekicks. It's a mini plot. We don't see that as often in our action stories in the US, but in Asia, there's this thought that if the villain can be defeated by one hero, then that wasn't much of a villain. So I see then that Jen and Shulin and Mu Bai, they all play that role from time to time. The hero is somebody who makes a sacrifice for someone else. So those are the heroes. The main villain, of course, as everyone has said, is Jade Fox. And what a villain she is. And her MacGuffin, it does shift a little bit. She's after the knowledge, but I think she's also after Jen, because with Jen, she, especially if she can control Jen, then she's more powerful. And then killing Mu Bai is a good goal too, a good object of desire for her, because he is pursuing her. And then she might as well take the sword, because if she kills everyone else, they're not going to need it. So she shifts what she's wanting depending on, you know, as the landscape changes, essentially. So I really see Jen as the primary victim, though Mu Bai obviously is targeted and ultimately killed. But she's the one, you know, in the end, the one who is the recipient of Jade Fox's bitter resentment. And the other thing I was thinking about her is that everybody wants something from her. Like everybody thinks she should be doing something. And I see how this, you know, can look like society or subjugation. But again, I really see that as part of her internal genre. So the next convention is the hero's object of desire is to stop the villain and save the victim. So we have different manifestations of this again, different times. Jen, Mu Bai, and Shulin are trying to stop Jade Fox and save Jen. But, you know, they also want to save Jen from herself and the ways that she is undermining her own safety. So the next convention is the power divide between the hero and the villain is very large. Like the villain is far more powerful than the hero. So one of the things I want to say about conventions and obligatory scenes and this kind of thing is you don't ever want to shoehorn, right? Like force the story events to fit a convention or obligatory scene, but sometimes we do need to think about them a little more broadly than the very literal description of them. And to me here, Jade Fox is not physically more powerful than the collective heroes. She doesn't have better skills. She's poison, which is a pretty good advantage because you can do that from a distance and thereby obviate the swords and that sort of thing. But I would say that in the end, for her big, nasty crime, the way that she is more powerful in that power divide is that Jen doesn't realize that her mentor is trying to kill her until the very end. And that's that reference in the title to hidden masters and things that can sneak up on you. So then the next convention is the speech in praise of the villain. And I have that coming from Inspector Sai. Jade Fox is a master criminal. I hear she infiltrated the Yus. She must have come with them when they transferred here. But with Yu's reputation, I can't just go in and accuse her. So she's really sneaky, and she's insulated herself really well. But then he also, at one point, he says, I doubt you can handle her. My wife was quite a martial arts expert, and Jade Fox killed her. So you need to leave this to the professionals. She's really hard to kill. And then the last is this: we have these specific conventions of subgenres. And assuming that Ang Lee was setting out to create a new genre here, then things that he would include would be, you know, the wires and the acrobatic martial arts of the Wong Fu. The traditional aesthetics and sense of order would be something you would include in a story like this. The internal genre of psychology and adding that to an action film. And then there are themes of courage, justice, and loyalty, especially to one's teachers. So that's what I have for that.
Thanks, Leslie. Jari, I think you had a comment?
Oh, just real quick. I mean, Leslie's insight into the hero collective, like she mentioned in the Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, that I was having a hard time trying to figure out who was doing what. And now when I thought about it from that perspective, especially from a Western story mindset, sometimes, you know, everything is always like happy endings and everything. And this just doesn't have that. But I like that perspective. I mean, looking at it again, rewatching the movie with that mentality, I think will be a better way to kind of get some of the muddledness out of my own head.
Thanks, Jari. Okay, finally, we have the point of view and the objects of desire. Kim, would you like to take us through both of those, please?
Sure. So the point of view is really straightforward. It's third person. You know, we have a lot of characters. We have this mini plot. So we have scenes where it does not just follow one character. And it's very clearly a third person telling. There is one place where we do have this flashback for Jen. You know, she's brushing her hair and she's thinking back. And then also when Lo actually shows up in her bedroom, we get the full flashback of when they met in the desert. And that feels very, you know, first person from Jen's point of view. Narrative device wise, there are some elements of mystery, as we've talked about here, that there's the masked, you know, the masked thief, the fact that Jade Fox is the posing as the governess, and then that we don't necessarily know what Jade Fox's motivations are until the very end. And so that's where Jade Fox knows more than we do, but we kind of have suspense with the rest of the characters where we're not really sure what's happening until then. So there are a little bit of elements of mystery. As far as the objects of desire, I did these from Jen's perspective because that was my protagonist. The wants, Jen wants to be a Wudang warrior, believing it to be a life of freedom and autonomy. Her needs, Jen needs a greater understanding of the world and consequences of her choices.
Okay, thanks, Kim. We like to end off every episode with some good examples, some special scene types, outstanding tropes, clear tie-ins to other genres. And of course, we've got a few for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Jari, would you like to start us off, please?
Yeah, thanks, Valerie. These action sequences are just awesome. It looks like a well-orchestrated ballet. You can even see that they're actually the actual actors, and it just is beautiful. I mean, the bamboo fight scene, the scenes on top of the roofs where they're flying away. I mean, this was, I think, the biggest revelation in Ang Lee's real power behind this. I mean, it's a good story, but the way it's shot and these action scenes are just awesome. It really innovated, I think, in that way. I think this was probably the first time mainstream Western audiences saw something like this.
Thanks, Jari. Cam, did you have an idea?
Yeah, I love the way that this feels very innovative of a genre. It feels, you know, like a Western story set in China, just like we had Firefly is a Western that's set in space. And I love the idea of what other genres and, you know, and settings and time periods could you juxtapose to create something fresh? So I think as a writer, as editors, as story lovers, that we can look at this. How do you take something that's, you know, and transplant it into a different place and make it something that's your own and still very, still resonates deeply with people on a story aspect, and having really strong subplots here too, really strong love subplots, and still have it hold up as a story. So I love the innovation. I love, you know, that even though it was written back in the 30s, it still feels very innovative to us from a Western audience because we hadn't really seen anything like it before. And I think that there is a real opportunity in that, to look for ways to contrast things that we don't normally see together and make something fresh and new.
And Leslie, the last word this week goes to you.
I wanted to say one thing to follow up what Kim was saying is that Ripper Street is actually a crime TV show, but it definitely has Western influences. It's pretty obvious that it's intentional. And that takes place in Whitechapel in London, which at the end of the 19th century was very much like the Wild West.
That's very interesting. I love that.
You can see those influences because even if you're not doing the global genre as a Western, some of those details can really add depth. And then I had just kind of a weird random thing that I noticed is that the interplay between Jade Fox, Jen, and the bandit Lo was in a way reminiscent to me of Miss Havisham and Estella and Pip in Great Expectations. And it may be something I ate, I don't know, but it was very stark to me, that older woman kind of controlling a younger woman and keeping her out of a relationship with someone that the younger woman at least is interested in and might want to form an attachment with.
Fantastic discussion, everybody. Thank you so much, Anne, Jari, Kim, and Leslie, for your excellent editorial insights into Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So we would love to hear what you think. Is it an action story? Is it a Western? Is it an internal status? Or is it a society story? You can let us know by contacting us on Twitter at StoryGridRT. We hope our discussion helps you think more clearly about the genre and genre expectations. Links to the Foolscap and other materials will be in the show notes document, and it's likely to be a hefty document this week. Thanks so much for joining us, and tune in again next time when we will embrace another of Ang Lee's great movies. We're going to tackle the love story with Brokeback Mountain. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thanks for joining us, everyone. We'll see you next week.